It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. When you think about an environmentally friendly car, you might think of an electric vehicle, but it's not always quite that simple. A new report from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy finds that this year's greenest car in America, as they rate it, is actually a plug-in hybrid, the 2024 Prius Prime SE. An expert on the automotive industry is with us now to help compare the environmental impacts of gas, electric, hybrid, and plug-in hybrid cars. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an electric, a hybrid, or plug-in hybrid car? What do you like about it? What led you to make that decision? If you've been thinking about taking the plunge but haven't yet, what has been holding you back so far? If you sell cars, what are you seeing when it comes to trends and what your customers want? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Micheline Maynard is a journalist and broadcaster based in Michigan with a long career in public radio along the way. She's the author of the book The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. And she has a Substack newsletter called Intersection, Everything That Moves. Mickey, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, I'm so happy to be back with you.
Well, as I mentioned, this one report says, hey, our greenest car, it's a plug-in hybrid. For people who haven't looked into these vehicles, what's the difference between a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid? It's right there in the name, I guess.
Exactly. So I have a Prius. It's my second Prius. And I have a little bit of experience with the hybrid. So a hybrid has a gasoline engine and a battery. Now, most of the time I run my Prius on gasoline and I get about 50 miles to the gallon, which is pretty great. But if I'm idling, if I'm going downhill, if I take my foot off the accelerator, it'll switch over to the battery. So I have battery power and I could hit a little button on my dashboard and run it only on the battery. It's not going to get me very far. That is the main issue. The battery is meant to boost the vehicle, but not run the vehicle. Mm-hmm. So then you have plug-in hybrids, and the plug-ins have bigger batteries that can hold more of a charge, which can get you places that probably the battery on my Prius can't get you. And the advantage to that is that you plug it in overnight and charge it up, and then you have kind of this dual feeling of power that you can drive on your gasoline engine or you can drive on your battery as well.
Now, when we ask a question like what car is the greenest, I assume it's going to depend in some ways on how we weigh different variables. But what kind of factors go into evaluating pollution emissions that come from different makes and models and types of cars?
So the acronym to know is ZEV, ZEV, which is zero emission vehicles. And so electric cars are zero emission vehicles because they don't emit carbon dioxide. Now, this is going to get a little bit in the weeds, but so you have your ZEVs, and then you have vehicles that are low emissions vehicles, which are what hybrids and plug-in hybrids are. And that's basically the point here is that the idea is to get rid of hydrocarbons and, you know, avoid polluting the air. And so if you want to do it in the purest fashion, you would do it with an electric vehicle. But you still have to build the electric vehicle. And there are people in the environmental movement who would say the idea isn't vehicles that don't pollute. It's not to have vehicles at all.
Another factor that I think this report I mentioned was weighing, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, they're saying, well, hang on, where is the electricity coming from? And for a lot of states, like Wisconsin, a decent amount of that comes from coal power plants. So they're trying to weigh, okay, if we're plugging in, what is the source of it? How much emission goes into that? Is that something that people you've seen, Mickey, try to factor in here?
Oh, absolutely. So coal powered, and then there are a lot of people that are saying, you know, as scary as nuclear power can seem, nuclear power is also fairly green, even though it's scary. So the coal powered plants, the nuclear powered plants, you could say that hydroelectric power is probably the cleanest of all of them, since it's water and water, you know, producing electricity. And that is a factor that a lot of people look at. And the grid is a huge issue because it's not going to only be individual cars and trucks and SUVs that'll be drawing on the grid. There is a real movement to decarbonize heavy trucks. So the, you know, the 18 wheelers and the big rigs that travel across the country. And California wants to have everything on its roads be zero emissions by 2050. And one of the ways that you decarbonize those big heavy trucks is by electrifying them. But boy, it's going to take a lot of electricity to charge a big truck versus, you know, my little sports car.
Talking to Mickey Maynard, longtime automotive reporter, looking at how we measure the environmental impact of different types of vehicles. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, the decisions you've made. If you've made a recent auto purchase, join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Eric is with us on the line in Endeavor. Eric, what did you want to share with us?
Well, I want to say one thing before I get to my point, but hydroelectrics, as the cleanest, unless you're a fish or the environment or a river, around the environment around the river. But we bought a hybrid car in about 4 or 5 years ago. It's a Toyota Avalon. It's very comfortable. We get 39 highway, 40 city. I cannot imagine buying another non-hybrid car at this point. Mm-hmm.
And Eric, have you thought about an EV, like going full electric, or is hybrid your sweet spot?
Right now, hybrid is a sweet spot because, I mean, we can go 500 miles on a gas tank of gas, and it's unbelievable the gas mileage it gets. Plus, because they're on leather seats, it's very comfortable. But I'm not afraid of electric vehicles. I haven't decided that yet.
Gotcha. Eric, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your experience. Mickey, what are we seeing with trends when it comes to consumer preferences? Are people going hybrid like Eric? How are EVs doing? What is happening on car lots around the country?
So I just want to address his point about hydroelectric power, and I totally understand what he's saying. You know, we don't want to ruin one environment to help another one. And I think you would have to look at that very carefully if we were going to go to that in a big way. So I think it's kind of delightful because in the last 20 years, so the Toyota Prius went on sale in the United States in 1999 and in Japan, I think, in 1996. And we've sold, I think they've sold 3 million hybrids. Toyota alone has sold 3 million hybrids. There are a lot of people who scoff at hybrids because their sales track gasoline prices. So when gasoline is under $2 a gallon, nobody cares about buying a hybrid, but gasoline is creeping up again. So we've got sort of these twin factors of gas prices are getting more expensive, and states and even the federal government are mandating cleaner vehicles. And instead of hybrids being something that you sort of scoff at, hybrids might be the answer. The technology exists. Toyota talks about electrifying its lineup, not electric vehicles, but hybrid electrics. The Camry will be only available as a hybrid, I believe, after the next model year. So I think this might be hybrid's time in the spotlight.
And I keep seeing things about, okay, yes, EV, full electric vehicle sales have gone up, but car lots now are kind of stacking them up and not sure what to do with them. What's been happening? Why has... go ahead.
Here's one of the issues with EVs. EV technology is moving very, very rapidly. And so an EV that you bought 2 years ago or leased 2 years ago and an EV that you leased 4 years ago are already outdated. And that's one of the reasons why EVs have piled up on lots and why one of the reasons why Hertz decided that it would get rid of 20,000 EVs. The technology is just changing so fast. You know, it's like the VCR Betamax thing way back when. And now we watch videos on our phone, you know. So that's one of the issues with EVs as well. It's, you know, the technology is really interesting technology. But I'll tell you one thing that's happening in China. There are a couple of Chinese EV manufacturers that allow you to swap the batteries. So there's a super cheap one that you can buy that's only about $2,500, but it doesn't come with the battery. Then you lease the battery and you basically tell them, oh, I drive 30 miles a day and you only need a battery that's this powerful. oh, I drive, you know, 100 mile a day commute, then you're going to want a battery that's that powerful. And then when you need a new battery, you just drive in and they swap it out and they give you a new battery. So there's no charging. You just go get a new battery. We don't have anything like that yet, but that is where the, at least in Asia, where the market is headed.
Micheline Maynard is with us, journalist, author, automotive industry expert, looking at the environmental impacts of hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and electric cars, how they stack up against old-fashioned gas cars, how to know what's right for you. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hesitant when it comes to electric and or hybrid vehicles, or have you made the switch yourself? What's your experience been like? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with journalist, author, and automotive industry expert Micheline Maynard. We're comparing the environmental impacts of electric, hybrid, and plug-in hybrid cars, how green they are compared to gas cars, and how to decide what's right for you. You could join in with your questions or to share your experiences, maybe if you bought a car recently, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Kathy is with us in Middleton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I am all for the environment. Trust me, but what I'm going to say may not sound that way. I am more concerned about my pocketbook. When I'm watching David Muir on TV at night and they talk about how the price of gas is going up and up or down and down or whatever, I think, oh, okay, that's what I have to live with. But nobody ever says what it costs to run an electric vehicle. Why don't they do that? And how much does it cost? How does it compare?
Kathy, thanks for the call. Mickey, how do we compare and contrast?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it depends on your electrical uses. And this is one of the things that is a little bit hard to quantify on EVs because, you know, if you live in a 6-bedroom house with 4 garages, you're probably already drawing on the grid pretty significantly. You might not even notice what your car is drawing because you have all this other electrical use. By contrast, if you live in a 1-bedroom apartment in New York City, and I actually do know people in New York City who run extension cords out the window so they can charge their car on their home grid, you might see a significant increase in the amount of electricity that you use simply because you don't use a lot of electricity to begin with. So at this point in time, people that I know who have owned electric vehicles say that the savings on gasoline, you know, so if gas is $4 a gallon, the amount that they save on gasoline versus the use of electricity, there's no question that electricity is much cheaper for these people. But right now, it's very, very hard to say what the average is going to be for everybody because it depends on your draw of the grid in other ways.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kathy. David joins us now in Madison. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a new EV owner at the start of this year, and so far I absolutely love it. It's the most quiet car I've ever owned. You know, and one of the issues I understand there is range anxiety. People don't buy because of range anxiety. Well, my 17-year-old car that pretty much died, we had range anxiety with that. So we had always just rented a car if we had to go super long distances. And that's what we're doing now with our EV. And then I guess the only other thing I would say is that we did choose to lease, which we never do. We usually buy. And one of the reasons was we thought the technology in 3 years could change dramatically.
Interesting.
And we probably didn't want to own that car.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Okay, a lot there, Mickey. Let's start with the range anxiety. David had a solution there. How big a factor is that still?
So range anxiety, it isn't so much range anxiety, how far the car can go. It's charging anxiety. Will you be able to charge the vehicle? So let me give you an example. If you look at our Midwest, most of the chargers are in urban, suburban, and college towns. For example, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, there are hardly any chargers. There are some, at Northern Michigan and Michigan Tech University. But otherwise, you know, the whole UP has a handful of chargers. Now, this is the big issue, and this was supposed to be addressed in the infrastructure bill. The Biden administration is supposed to be spending millions of dollars setting up more chargers, but Politico reported last year that not a single charger had been set up. So charging anxiety is an issue. Obsolete technology is obviously an issue. And I think leasing an electric vehicle is probably the way to go, because it's all changing very rapidly. And Toyota is even looking at a different kind of battery than everybody else is using. And so you don't want to be stuck with the old battery when the new battery comes in and turns out to be much more efficient. And I did want to get back to Kathy's point about charging. So there is one study that shows it costs about $50 a month to charge a basic electric car, not, you know, one of the big pickup trucks, versus maybe $130 a month if you have a regular commute. So there is a great savings potential, but it also, as I said, depends on how much you use electricity and what your bill is anyway.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Micheline Maynard, longtime automotive industry reporter, about how we compare and contrast the greenness, the environmental value of hybrid, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Mickey, before we go back to our callers, you'd mentioned, you know, some of the state-of-the-art in China right now. One issue here in the U.S. is we've got dueling priorities from the Biden administration. They want to promote more electric vehicles. They don't want to promote imports from China, which has been a leader in EVs right now. How is all that shaking out?
Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago, President Biden kind of inexplicably tweeted and put on social media that we're not going to allow the Chinese to flood the American market with EVs. Well, no, we're not, because the Trump administration placed a 27.5% tariff on imported Chinese EVs. So first of all, the Chinese would have to look at the American market and say, you know, is it worth having to lose 27.5% of our profit or whatever by sending vehicles there? But I do think the Chinese are clearly the leaders in electric vehicles. The government there in 2010 really promoted the idea of EVs, and 300 different brands jumped into the market and started duking it out for customers. There are about 100 brands left that sell EVs, and about 30 of them are the super competitors. The biggest one is BYD, or Build Your Dream, and BYD is the company that I'm watching the most closely. You know, they're the Toyota of electric vehicles in China. They have their own fleet of freighters. They recently sent their first freighter to Denmark and England. And a friend of mine tweeted the other night a photo of the first BYD in London. So BYD has 7 more freighters that it can fill up and send vehicles around the world. So I would be willing to predict that we'll see them in the United States someday.
Let's go back to our callers. Mitch is on the line in Green Bay. Mitch, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was a truck driver in the 90s, and I was on the route of a big electric car race. It was put on by either Mechanics Illustrated or Popular Science, and they had a lot of schools participating, MIT and other engineering schools. And I got to watch the racers come by me, very silent and very interesting, in that they made all of their own electricity. And they were not battery powered. They were not on the grid and everything else. And I'm wondering just
where
that's going.
Did they have solar panels, Mitch, or what were they doing?
Sounds like a solar race. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Is there any industrial application for that? Will we see consumer cars with some of their own solar producing energy, Mickey?
We might see solar as a contributor. I don't think you're going to be able to run an American sized sedan or SUV on solar in the near future, but you know, there are some solar panels built into sunroofs, and you might be able to run accessories on the dashboard that way. So, no, never rule anything out. The way technology is going, you know, we could see solar washing machines.
Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. Matthew is with us now in Madison. Matthew, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've owned electric vehicles for 8 years now. I started with a plug-in hybrid, the Chevy Volt, and we still have it. And then a few years later, we got a Tesla Model S used. And at the used price, we could afford it. And then to make it affordable, I was renting them out through Turo. I'm not doing that anymore. But so that's kind of been a little bit of my story. And the piece that I wanted to share is how much fun they are to drive.
Interesting, Matthew. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet, Mickey. Are these plug-in hybrids, et cetera, fun to drive?
Oh, absolutely. I have ridden in Tesla taxis, you know, Lyfts and Ubers, and I'm there a blast. And the I mean, he had a Model S, and the Model S is, you know, really pretty high powered. I think they're fun to drive. They're very quiet. And that's one of those things that scares people, is that they just kind of show up behind you and you don't know that they're there. But yeah, and I think if we get some serious competition for Tesla in this country, the electric vehicle market in the next decade could be very, very interesting. I don't know if the Detroit company's hearts are really in it, because they make so much money on pickups and SUVs, and electric vehicles will be a drag on their results for several years going forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see imports and Tesla taking the leadership on EVs and Detroit kind of doing what they feel they have to do.
Thanks for that call. And Mickey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thanks to everybody who called in.
That's Micheline Maynard, journalist and broadcaster. She's the author of the book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. She has a Substack newsletter. It's called Intersection, Everything That Moves. She was with us today to talk about the environmental impacts of gas, electric, hybrid, and plug-in hybrid cars, how to decide which car might be best for you. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. House passed a bill this week that would ban the social media app TikTok if its parent company, ByteDance, doesn't sell the platform. The legislation was introduced by Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher, who said on the House floor that it's not about censorship, but instead about concerns over ByteDance's connection to the Chinese government.
It only applies to companies subject to the control of foreign adversaries defined by Congress. It says nothing about election interference and cannot be turned against any American social media platform. It does not impact websites in general. The only impacted sites are those associated with foreign adversary apps, such as TikTok.com. It can never be used to penalize individuals. The text explicitly prohibits that, and it cannot be used to censor speech. It takes no position at all on the content of speech, only foreign adversary control.
The bill passed the House by a wide margin with bipartisan support. Wisconsin Democratic U.S. Representatives Gwen Moore and Mark Pocan voted against it, though. President Biden has said he would sign the law if it passes through Congress. It's not clear if the Senate will take it up. Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin said in a statement to WPR that she supports the bill, but Senate leaders have been noncommittal about moving it forward. We're checking in on why congressional leaders want to ban the app if it doesn't get sold and what impact a ban or sale could have on social media users. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support this push to either ban TikTok or force its sale? Are you worried about TikTok's ties to the Chinese government? Are you a user of the social media platform? If it went away, what would that mean for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Katie Bartson-Culver is a professor and director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's the director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be here.
Before we get into Congress here, Katie, some of our users, I'm sure, are closely familiar with TikTok. Others, not so much. Remind us what happens on it and its place in the social media landscape.
Its place in the social media landscape is unparalleled. It has huge usage numbers. For those who have never used the app, I will confess I'm not a power user, but my children sure are. And it's short content, often video-based, very, very entertaining, and also very, very addictive. Because it feeds content to you based in part on what you've watched before, you can, for instance, I have a friend who gets a lot of cake decorating videos on her TikTok, and she can lose 45 minutes to watching other people decorate cakes without even thinking about it.
And this comes before Congress, not because of the cakes or the addictive nature of it, but because it's ByteDance, the parent company, is based in China. There's a general recognition that if you're a company based in China, the Chinese government has a lot of access to what you do. Can you talk about that background and why Representative Gallagher and others are worried about that?
Yeah, so here it's not just that the Chinese Communist Party would have access to what the company does, but that the CCP could have influence on TikTok's algorithms. And that's the central issue. So an algorithm is a series of codes that decides what is going to get fed to individual users. And we're all familiar with it on other social media, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. It's based in part on your past usage. Algorithms are based in part on your past usage. And they're also famously and very negatively based on enragement as engagement. So we tend to stay longer on apps when we become negatively emotionally activated. And so the concern here is that the Chinese Communist Party could have propaganda aims and be feeding us negative content that polarizes us as Americans, gives us false information about our position in the world, and ultimately influences elections. That's what Mike Gallagher and others are concerned about. There's also a question of ByteDance having access to U.S. users' data in pernicious ways.
I want to give a listen to the head of ByteDance, TikTok's parent company. This is Shou Chu pushing back against the legislation. Here's some of what he had to say.
Over the last few years, we have invested to keep your data safe and our platform free from outside manipulation. We have committed that we will continue to do so. This legislation, if signed into law, will lead to a ban of TikTok in the United States. Even the bill sponsors admit that that's their goal. This bill gives more power to a handful of other social media companies. It will also take billions of dollars out of the pockets of creators and small businesses. It will put more than 300,000 American jobs at risk, and it will take away your TikTok.
So a lot in there, Katie. First of all, Shou Chu referring to what some people call Project Texas, where under pressure from the federal government, the company contracted with an outside group, had a location in Texas that they say, their data is separate from anything that's held in China. And they're arguing that, hey, we've done enough to address these concerns. It gets complicated. Obviously, members of the House not buying that argument.
You know, I think the arguments are a bit disingenuous. So, yes, there has been some action on the data privacy front, but we're really not seeing any opening of the algorithm to inspection. Mm-hmm. And that has led many, and I will include myself in that list, to be very skeptical about what is going on behind the scenes. And we do have some analysis from the Wall Street Journal, for instance, and other academic institutions that show some really skewed content delivery, particularly to younger users. After October 7th, the Israel-Hamas war, and some real tilt in what was being delivered. Also, real tilt on what's delivered about the U.S. economy, that despite the fact that the U.S. economy is significantly stronger than China's right now, TikTok feeds giving the impression that we're at the lowest economic point since the 1930s and that we're in a quote-unquote silent depression. So these feeds can really have influence because of the amount of time people are spending on this app. The other thing I think is disingenuous is that this connection that forcing a sale of TikTok from ByteDance to make it available in the US will result in a ban. There's no way these folks are going to leave as much money on the table as TikTok produces. If a sale is forced, a sale will happen. You know, those people who love TikTok will continue to have TikTok. They'll just have it with an algorithm that is, you know, potentially that is not influenced potentially by a foreign adversary.
Katie Barton-Culver is with us from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at TikTok. The U.S. House passed a bill by a pretty wide margin saying TikTok needs to either be sold or blocked from appearing on app stores based on its connections to the Chinese government. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, TikTok is a pretty new phenomenon in the scope of American history. Do we have any comparables here where we're saying, hey, some sort of communication platform's got to either be sold or gotten rid of based on its connection to a foreign government, a foreign adversary?
We really don't, because the most dominant social media have been based in the U.S., have been founded in the U.S., and their algorithms are within the U.S. context. Now, that's not to say that, you know, we could never have something outside of our, you know, that we ought to dominate, that if it's not U.S. owned, it's problematic in some way. So the case here is concerns about propaganda. And I think it was pretty well borne out this week when TikTok delivered an activation message to younger users saying, you know, they algorithmically detected who a 13-year-old's representative was in Congress and delivered a phone number saying, call and tell them not to ban TikTok. Mm-hmm. And thousands of tweens and young people reached out to their senators and their congresspeople, which sort of proved the point that TikTok can activate its users to engage politically.
We're talking about TikTok and a push in Congress to either ban the app or force its parent company to sell it. Our guest is UW-Madison journalism professor Katie Culver. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use TikTok? If so, what for? How would a TikTok ban affect you if this bill passes, the company doesn't sell, and it goes away? Do you think the government should be taking action here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Katie Barton-Culver, communications professor, director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. With us today to talk about the social media app TikTok after the U.S. House passed a bill that would ban the platform if its parent company doesn't sell it off. Some buying groups getting together, including one led by Steven Mnuchin, as we're hearing in the news today, former Treasury Secretary, looking to buy if they sell. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So my question is there a U.S. company that has the same reach into the Chinese market that TikTok does into the U.S.? And then secondly, has this happened before? And I guess if I was to follow up, I guess that's my question. It's so.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. My understanding is that, say, Facebook, you can get it in China. You have to do some work to get there. There's a lot more control over what goes in and out of people's computers there. Do you have any comparable situations in your mind, Katie?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. It's an excellent question, actually, excellent pair of questions. So, you cannot access U.S. social media in China without significant mm-hmm. government interference. Some people refer to it as the Great Firewall, the Great Firewall of China, as opposed to the Great Wall. And so there is reach of our social media companies, but not unfettered. So again, with the idea of disingenuousness, the fact that the U.S. would be regulating a foreign-owned company, our companies are certainly quite regulated in China. There is some concern among some commentators that this bill could cause serious blowback. That the Chinese government might try to force disinvestment in China of U.S. companies, you know, Apple manufacturing, for instance, or could disrupt supply chains in retaliation. But there is precedent in the United States. For instance, the Soviet Union could not have owned a broadcast television license in the 1950s or even today. So we do regulate foreign ownership of media in other spheres.
Thanks a lot for the call and the question, Chris. We'll go to Gene now in Eagle River. Gene, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to understand the algorithm issue. You indicated that they are not willing to give access to the algorithm that they use with TikTok. Do other companies give access? Do other I don't quite understand the algorithm, but do other folk, other social media platforms give that? Other companies give their algorithms? My understanding is nobody offers that. So why would they give us what their algorithm is?
Interesting question, Gene. Algorithm's kind of a crown jewels, I imagine, for a lot of social media companies, Katie.
Yeah, Gene, you hit on something that is going to be one of the biggest First Amendment battles of the next decade, is whether an algorithm is considered expression and therefore protected under the First Amendment. In the U.S. context, there are plenty of state attorneys general and federal regulators and congresspeople who would very much love to have Mark Zuckerberg be forced to open up the algorithms for, let's say, Instagram, because we have research demonstrating problematic effects of Instagram feeds for the mental health of particularly young girls, teenage girls. So no, we don't have Twitter's algorithm opened up here. But as part of, you know, the lengthy negotiations before getting to the point of proposing this bill, it, you know, folks were saying, look, if you let us see behind the curtain, maybe a forced sale would not be necessary. But you're not letting us, so we think that a forced sale is necessary.
Thanks a lot for that call. Katie, one notion that's been brought up by some critics of the bill, including at least some in the Wisconsin congressional delegation, is, you know, okay, yes, this foreign ownership is a worry, but we need to be doing more on all these platforms to protect Americans' data privacy, maybe more to regulate what is forced to our eyes by algorithms. Are there, whether we agree or disagree with the TikTok plan, are there wider things that you would like to see when it comes to social media regulation?
Sure. I think we could just cast our eyes toward the European Union to see some interesting attempts to deal with the effects of social media. You know, these are very useful and can be very positive tools, but they come with negative ramifications. And these companies have very, very strong protections in the U.S. under what's called Section 230. So Section 230 protects platforms, social media companies, from being sued for many things. So for instance, if I were to defame someone, if I were to say that the host of Central Time is selling cocaine out of the Wisconsin Public Radio offices falsely.
Yes, it's very false.
Falsely,
I
of
do
course.
Sometimes buy Girl Scout cookies. That's as far as I go.
If I publish that in the Wisconsin State Journal, you can sue me and the Wisconsin State Journal for defamation. If I publish it on Facebook, you can sue me, but you cannot sue Facebook. So that is tremendous protection for these companies, and has made it hard to hold them accountable for the things that they do. I would say regulation, you know, in Europe, for instance, for they age gate for automatic feeds. So YouTube, for instance, if you're a user under, I believe it's 18, and you're on YouTube, it's maybe only in some European countries, I want to be careful with my facts, you don't get automatically delivered a next video. You have to actually make a choice to go on. So it doesn't give that sort of addictive feed sense. So there are things that we could do to, you know, delay the time, you know, the age at which people can get on these apps. And, you know, changing the way automatic feeds happen, having algorithmic transparency so we know if something is being delivered to us because it emphasizes conflict. And I would say, yes, I think we need a lot more attention to social media companies in the United States and their effects. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do something about TikTok. Let's start somewhere and think about the effects of these things.
Katie. We'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much, and thanks to the callers. Great questions.
That's Katie Bartson-Culver, communications professor and director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She also directs the Center for Journalism Ethics. She was with us today to talk about a push in Congress to ban TikTok or force its parent company to sell the social media app. That bill has passed in the U.S. House. Next step, the Senate. In the fall, four University of Wisconsin River Falls students died by suicide in less than 2 months. This semester, campus officials are offering counseling and mental health events. Corrine Hess reports that some students say they want more.
It's another Mental Health Monday on the UW River Falls campus. About 30 students are gathered at the University Center. The theme of this Mental Health Monday is sleep. Some are making aromatherapy oils. Others spin a wheel to win a sleep mask. Counselors want students to understand relaxation and healthy sleep habits are linked to better mental health. These student gatherings are part of the university's response to a series of suicides on campus. In the fall, four UW River Falls students died by suicide in less than 2 months. Students say they're happy to have Mental Health Mondays, but they're looking for more.
It's a great way to bring people together, but nobody talks about the suicides that happened last semester.
That's freshman Chloe Skilly. She says she understands people are trying to move on, but losing four classmates in 8 weeks was unprecedented. Campus officials say the students' deaths were not directly linked. They're treating them as a suicide cluster because of the connections on the small campus. And that meant taking steps to avoid copycat suicides. Mental Health Mondays are one part of those efforts. Administrators have also made counselors available and even identified students on campus who could be at risk. But some students feel like they've been cut off from their ability to discuss the deaths. During winter break, campus officials removed a student-created memorial wall filled with handwritten notes and flowers. They say this was in line with mental health professionals' recommendations. Freshman RJ Forgia says the memorial was a place students could sit with their emotions.
People heal and grow after like such a loss, but like no one wants to forget about it. We're still like ready and willing to have these conversations.
Chancellor Maria Gallo says the university is not stopping students from having conversations about those who died, but she says those conversations are more appropriate in smaller groups.
Very personal and tragic circumstances, and I think that the students don't always realize that that's how it has to be, and it's the right thing to do to respect the families.
At the 5,000-person campus, many of the students knew at least one of the people who died last year. Annie Loss had classes and was in the same dorm as two of the women who died. Loss says she was worried about returning to school this semester because of her own struggles with mental health. She's a biochemistry major and said the pressure is sometimes too much to handle.
Classes are extremely difficult. Every class I go into and the harder they get, I feel dumber and dumber. Mental health-wise, it's still really challenging to get through.
The mental health crisis at UW River Falls is not unique to the campus. It's mirrored across the state and country. According to federal data, between 2007 and 2021, the suicide rate among people aged 24 and younger increased 62%. In Wisconsin, a recent survey from the state's Office of Children's Mental Health found 1 in 10 teens attempted suicide last year. The report found many young people feel stress or even hopelessness about issues like academic pressure, gun violence, and climate change. Loss says her friends and parents help her deal with anxiety and mental health struggles. She's hoping the focus UW River Falls has placed on mental health will continue beyond this year. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you or someone you know is dealing with a mental health emergency, there is help out there. Among other places, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available. The number there is 988. Again, that's 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You can follow that story and more over at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Dig into the U.S. federal budget, the latest stopgap plans, and some long-term proposals, including a budget proposal from the Biden administration, and where it all fits into the national debt and efforts to bring it down over the years. Join that conversation right now. You can email with your thoughts and questions, ideas@WPR.org, and then join in tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Happy Pi Day to all who celebrate. If you haven't heard about this today or over the years, people have been celebrating March 14th as Pi Day in recent years. Why? Because the date, 314 or 314, is the first three digits of the number pi, 3.14, and so on. Without the number pi, we couldn't do circles, like the food pie. How do we celebrate Pi Day? No surprise, we eat pie. Here at WPR, a bunch of folks brought in pie to share. I had an errand, so I missed the initial release of the pie, so it was pretty picked through by the time I got to it, but that's okay, because Tuesday we had family over and bought a berry pie. I'm pretty sure there's still some left over waiting for me at home tonight. It's a Pi Day miracle. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Ultra-processed foods are associated with over 30 different medical problems, including type 2 diabetes and heart disease. That's according to a review of research published in the British Medical Journal. Ultra-processed foods make up 58% of the calories Americans consume, according to that same study. But figuring out what counts as ultra-processed is not always easy. We're going to check out the link between ultra-processed foods and various health problems, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got a Wisconsin nutrition expert with us. Do you have a question about sorting out which foods are maybe too processed to be healthy versus better, healthier options? When you are shopping, how do you balance convenience and healthiness in your diet? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Beth Olson is an associate professor of nutritional sciences in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be speaking with you again.
When we use a phrase like ultra-processed food, you know, as food consumers, we might have certain things pop into our heads. When we're talking about researchers trying to categorize ultra-processed foods and studies like this, what are we talking about here, Beth?
So I think of that exactly how you do, in two different ways. One is how researchers look at it. There's a group that made a list of rules about what qualifies as ultra-processed or one of the other categories that they have. And researchers are using that to look at how is a high intake of those kind of foods associated with certain health outcomes. But for consumers, it's different. It's a list of rules. It's not a list of foods. So there's no way to pick up a food and say, well, this is ultra processed or not. And for that, then we have to interpret that and give probably very similar guidance to what we've been given to people for a long time about what are the best things to choose to eat most often.
And before we dig too deep into the research, let's front load this here. What are some of those rules of thumb when we're at grocery stores or restaurants to try to figure out, more food-like, more healthy versus, hey, maybe that's too processed to be healthy?
Well, we can use a couple of things. One is perhaps some common sense. You know, when you're the produce aisle and you're looking at the fruits and the vegetables, those are going to be good foods for you. Often people will say shop around the perimeter of the store. That's where your dairy's going to be. And other things like that. The other thing is to look at labels. So when you are in the middle of the store and picking up a can or a box or a frozen package, look at the label and say, you know, how much fiber does this have in? What's the ingredient listing? Does it list whole wheat or does it list, you know, a different kind of refined grain, for instance?
What are some of the foods where we're most likely to run into this kind of ultra processing where it looks less and less like food to our bodies?
Well, certainly, if someone thinks of snack categories or treat categories, so pretty much everything in that aisle that has chips and crackers and other what we would call, some people would call junk foods or foods like that, or in the candy aisle where you're getting candies and other treats, baked goods that would have a lot of added sugar. All of those foods are certainly going to fall into that ultra-processed category.
What is it about these ultra-processed foods that may be linked with bad health outcomes down the road? Is it bad stuff in the food itself, or is that we're eating that instead of the good stuff?
You know, Rob, that's the million-dollar question, and I think it's probably both. It's that you're eating foods that are probably higher in fat. They may be making your blood sugar rise more quickly than we would like. They may not have ingredients that we need for our guts to be healthy, the microbiome that we're all been talking about recently, the bacteria in our gut, like fiber. So part of it's that, part of it's indeed that we're crowding out all the foods that we recommend people eat. If people actually followed the dietary guidelines, which is the government's guidance, and ate the foods that are recommended, they just wouldn't have as much room left in their diet for the ultra-processed foods.
Beth Olson is with us, Associate Professor of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. We are talking about ultra-processed foods, some recent studies finding connections between eating a diet heavy in these ultra-processed foods and a variety of health conditions that you don't want. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how all of this works? How do you make your decisions in what to eat and serve and when? Is it a battle sometimes between convenience? You know the food isn't maybe as good for you, but it's ready and it's fast. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Beth, I want to talk about access to the healthier foods. We sometimes hear about food deserts where people don't have access to, say, that fresh produce aisle, people without enough money or enough time to prepare foods. What are some things we can do to help in those situations connect people with the good stuff?
So we can take different approaches. One would be more of a policy approach, an environmental approach. So working in communities to have better stores in our, you know, local neighborhoods so people have access to those foods. Other policies related to providing or incentives to purchase them, or perhaps just making them accessible to those who don't have as much money, you know, having healthy foods available in our schools, for instance, so that any kid coming to school can have a healthy meal. But then we can also do education, which I work with Extension, and they do a lot of nutrition education where they work with people on, if this is what you have available, how do you make choices among those that are best? How do I make them with the money that I do have? How do I read labels to maximize the nutrients I get for the dollars I spend?
One concern I've seen brought up in these conversations, Beth, is the idea that some of these ultra-processed foods are engineered to be, I think I've seen the phrase, hyper-palatable, meaning they make us want to eat them and keep on eating them. I think a lot of us have had that experience maybe with a bag of chips. How big a problem is this? Is this actually leading us to eat more calories and more salt, sugar, and fat that in those doses aren't so good for us?
Sure. Food manufacturers know how to make food taste good. That's their business. And it will contribute to us perhaps eating a bit more than we should be. I think it also comes from how we're brought up, what we get used to. So if what we're brought up is with these foods, and then that's what we prefer. But if we can help families choose other foods for their littlest kids so that they grow up exposed to fruits and vegetables and, you know, whole grains and other things, and develop some preference at least or liking for them, I think that could also go a ways to helping us not feel like the only choices we have that are going to be tasty are going to be the big bag of chips.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Piero is with us in Wauwatosa. Piero, hi.
Hi, good evening. I just want to make a brief comment that can help the listeners to identify processed food, which is any food your grandmother would not recognize, that is processed food. Another another hint, another suggestion is any food that comes in a box and it has a UPC code probably is not real food.
Piero, thanks for the call. Beth, I've seen that argument. I think that might be a Michael Pollan thing, that if your grandparents wouldn't recognize this food or make it, it isn't really food. I don't know. What do you think of that idea as a rule of thumb?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's also a difference, and most researchers and nutritionists see a difference between processed and ultra-processed. So, indeed, much of the food we eat now compared to, indeed, what my grandmother got in her garden is processed, but it doesn't mean that that's all unhealthy. So, there are many people who just aren't going to have their own home garden or be able to go to a farmer's market. There's people who can't get to the store often enough. And so for those folks, there are plenty of healthful options that do come in boxes or cans or in the frozen food aisle, frozen canned fruits and vegetables, whole grain breads. There are many choices. So I think it's a little too simple to say that if your grandmother didn't prepare it, it wouldn't be healthy.
Piero, thanks for that call. Beth Olson is with us, Associate Professor of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. She's talking with us about a new review of research on potential health issues that come from eating ultra-processed foods. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have advice on foods, meals that are convenient and affordable but don't sacrifice when it comes to nutrition? What is your relationship to these kind of ultra-processed foods we're talking about? Do you find yourself drawn to eat a lot of them? No shame in that. I love these things. I try not to eat them so much as I used to. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison Nutritional Sciences Professor Beth Olson about ultra-processed foods and what we know about their effects on our health and healthier eating options. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about ultra-processed foods, what they are, the nutritional value they have or lack of same? Can you talk a little bit about your decision-making when you're preparing food, buying food? Are there some snacks you steer clear of because it doesn't seem like they're really food in the first place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Beth, a deeply personal question for me that may have relevance for others. I eat breakfast cereal. I've eaten it my whole life, probably eaten a disturbing amount. But my rule generally when I'm buying it is I look at the label. If it's got like 4 grams of fiber or more, that makes me think, okay, there's some real food substance in here. Am I fooling myself?
No, not at all. I think that's a great rule of thumb. And I think one of the ways I've talked to people about choosing foods, breakfast cereal could be something else, bread, soup, is if that's what you want to eat, pick up a selection of them and turn the labels over and compare. So are you picking up food that has more fiber, more whole grain in it, like a bread or a cereal? If you're doing a soup, does it have more fiber? Does it have more vegetables? Does it have a leaner meat in it? Or does it have more added fat or the foods have added sugars? So pick the soup, but look among the soups and make the best choice among those. Pick the cereal, but pick the best cereal among the ones that are available to you.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dana is with us now in West Bend. Hi, Dana.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering about a lot of like DIY recipes. So you find something, you know, that you really like, but you're trying to take out all of that high processed stuff. But you're still kind of making the same thing. Where does that fall?
And Dana, do you have a specific example in mind, maybe one you've tried or thought about trying?
Yeah, so Pop-Tarts, for example, right? Super high processed, but like you can make a homemade pastry, but you're still having lots of sugar and stuff. So I guess, does it really make an impact?
Interesting, Dana. What do you think, Beth? Substituting a homemade Pop-Tart or what have you, making it at home?
Yeah, she brings up a great point that it isn't always exactly that the food was made at home or it was made at a plant and shipped to your store. It's what's in it. So you could make almost the same recipe at home and wouldn't necessarily make it a lot healthier. Now, alternatively, you could. So perhaps instead of buying the packaged heat up lasagna, you're making lasagna at home and you're making it with a leaner meat or a leaner, a lower fat cheese, or you're making it with some whole grain pasta, or you're putting in fresh tomatoes. So I think there are ways to take some of those recipes and make them in a healthier way. And you have to decide which of those is worth it and which might be worth just not eating that food.
Dana, thanks a lot for that call. As I understand it, Beth, a lot of times when we talk about ultra processed foods, it's a matter of, you know, breaking down that grain or potato or whatever ingredient into really a component element, extruding it, and then shaping it into the chip or the Pop-Tart or something like that. That's something we're not doing at home. It almost seems like if we're at least starting with, you know, some actual flour or something like that, or oats or a potato to make our own chips, it seems like that's going to be a little better.
Oh, yes, indeed. You can use more whole foods. You wouldn't be adding in ingredients that, you know, we don't need. They're perhaps, you know, necessary for a food manufacturer. That is, you know, we make something in our kitchen and then we eat it. They're making something in a plant. They have to ship it. Sometimes it has to be frozen or be on a shelf. So they need to add some things so things don't separate, you know, so things don't mold, whatever. And we can eliminate that when we make it at home.
Thanks again for that call and that question at 800-642-1234. Fran is with us now in Viroqua. Fran, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a question for your guest regarding protein powders and protein drinks and bars. I have two very, very busy teenagers, and sometimes that's the easiest thing that they can grab to give them fuel for sports activities and dance and just all of their other activities. So I'm just curious what your guest thinks about those types of options. We try to be as natural and plant-based as possible, but I still believe they're processed. So just wondering if that's the best option.
Fran, thanks for the call. What do you think, Beth?
Yeah, she brings up another good point, which is sometimes a processed food is what we need at the moment. You know, just not many of us are going to eat all unprocessed foods. And often the people that can afford a little bit of something that might be a little bit more processed are people who are perhaps more active and they're on the move, like teens, people in sports. And I think, again, there's probably a variety of different kinds of bars, protein bars or energy bars. I know there are a large variety available. So one could read the label and look for one that has more whole ingredients, maybe has a little bit of fiber, has maybe a fewer added ingredients. So even among those, just making the best choice. But I think, you know, sometimes there's really a role for that grab and go kind of thing.
Fran, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helps. Beth, one thing that struck me some years ago is that, you know, there were some products, breakfast bars and things like that, that would be labeled low fat. So great, they're healthy food. But then when you think about it, they're heavily processed. There might be a lot of sugar added to add some flavor when that fat is gone. How do we distinguish a food that might make some kind of healthy claim on the label, but have some sinister stuff down beneath it?
Yeah, what's on labels is, quite variable. Certain things on it are regulated in one way and certain things are regulated another. I tell people, I think the safest thing to do is look on that nutrition facts panel and the ingredients label and see how well those line up too. So look at the ingredient label, and if it has grain ingredients, look up above and see, does it have fiber? And if not, then those are probably refined grains. So I would say look there. And not worry as much when something says low fat or high in vitamin C or something else. Because, of course, even when we look at our whole diet, looking at a single nutrient or a single property isn't all that helpful. We kind of want to look at the picture as a whole.
Talking to nutrition expert Beth Olson from UW-Madison, looking at ultra-processed foods and some of the health risks that could be involved with them. Beth, let's talk about sugar and stealth sugar that pops up in surprising foods. And it's trickier sometimes than just reading a label and looking for the word sugar. What are some of the words we're looking for to see the different kinds of sugars out there on the market?
Yeah, so I don't even know if I can give you the whole list because there's quite a bit, but brown sugar, white sugar, cane sugar, but then there's things, you know, honey, can be added to products to make them sweeter and really isn't going to do anything more for you than, you know, white or brown sugar. So that's another added sugar. Certainly the syrups, high fructose corn syrup, of course, is a major sweetener that we use here in the U.S., especially in soda pops. So yeah, you really have to read them all and look for all the syrups and invert sugar. And so any word with sugar, any word with syrup. And now on the food label, manufacturers do, if it's a processed food, they do have to add if it has added sugars. We didn't have to do that in the past. So you didn't always have a way of knowing if the sugar in there was naturally occurring or added by the manufacturer, but now they do. So look on the label for added sugars.
Time for one more caller. Chelsea is with us in Hartford. Chelsea, hi.
Hi. I actually have I've been making this recipe for my husband. He gets up in the morning and needs breakfast bars, and I've been making this recipe for many moons. And it is raw blueberries, probably a handful, and one banana, one egg, and I put raw oats in there as well. And I mix it up, and I bake it on a sheet flat. I spread it on a sheet, cookie sheet flat, and bake it and cut them into bar sizes. And that's his breakfast bar for the morning. And it is, every once in a while, I'll add, like, extra, like, protein powder or different kind of additives, depending upon how we're feeling or
excellent,
how I want the flavor. And that's something that I've used forever. And my husband, who never ate lunch before, never ate breakfast before, he loves them.
Chelsea, thanks a lot for sharing that. Maybe I can place an order after the show. It sounds pretty good. Beth, some creative cooking, and it sounds like you can make a bunch of these things at once. Whether people make that exact recipe, what do you think of that idea of substituting a home-baked breakfast bar?
I think that's a great idea. And I mean, she's putting in, not just making it herself, but putting in some wonderful ingredients, things that are healthy, the blueberries and the oats. And, you know, one of the things she's doing in order to have that happen is she's planning ahead. Mm-hmm. She had to go to the store and get that. She had to make it. And that's one thing, if we're able, and not everybody has this time and not everybody has these resources, but if we're able to plan ahead, we can think, you know, this is going to be a busy week. I do this myself. I'll say, this is going to be a busy week. I'm going to get some frozen vegetables to make sure if I don't have time to make fresh, I can use those frozen ones, or I can put them into a soup. So thinking ahead, it's good to plan ahead and maybe buy some of those ingredients, whether they are in a package or fresh, and have them on hand, have them in your pantry. So you're ready to go on the night when you just don't have time to spend a lot of time on dinner.
Chelsea, thanks for sharing that with us. And Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Me too. That's Beth Olson, Associate Professor of Nutritional Sciences in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. She talked to us today about new research on ultra-processed foods. Hey, if you have an easy, healthy food tip to share with us, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, rural hospitals are closing in western Wisconsin and elsewhere. Find out why and what it means for people and their health care in those parts of the state. And it's Food Friday with a focus on sauce with the new cookbook Saucy, 50 Recipes for Great Sauces. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.